Absorbed in one another, Wireman and Gedwin did not hear him riding up on them. Gedwin was idly playing with his reins, his features cold with contempt. The tyrant was red-faced. "I don't care who you are," he was saying to the black-coated man in a low, hard voice, spittle flying. "I won't take more risk without a command direct from the lips of—" Abruptly the pair became aware of Bertome, and Wireman's mouth snapped shut. He glared as if he wanted to kill Bertome. The Ashaman's ever-present smile melted away. The wind gusted, cold and sharp, as clouds drifted across the sun, but no colder than Gedwin's sudden stare. With a small shock, Bertome realized the man also wanted to strike him dead on the spot. Gedwin's icily murderous gaze did not change, but Wireman's face underwent a remarkable transformation. The red faded slowly as he produced a smile in an instant, an oily smile with only a trace of mocking condescension.
"I've been thinking about you, Bertome," he said heartily. "A pity Althor strangled your cousin. With his own hands, I hear. Frankly, I was surprised you came when he called. I've seen him watching you. I fear he plans something more interesting for you than thrashing your heels on the floor while his fingers tighten on your throat."
Bertome suppressed a sigh, and not only at the fool's clumsiness. A good many thought to manipulate him with Colivert's death. She had been his favorite cousin, but ambitious beyond reason. Saigon had good claims to the Sun Throne, yet she could not have held it against the strength of Rhiaton or Damodred, either one, let alone both together, not without the open blessings of the White Tower or the Dragon Reborn. Still, she had been his favorite. What did Wireman want? Certainly not what it seemed on the surface. Even this tyrant oaf was not that simple. Before he could frame any response, a horseman came galloping toward them through the trees ahead. A Kyrianan. And as he reined to a sudden halt in front of them, that made his horse sit back on its haunches, Bertome recognized one of his own armsmen, a gap-toothed fellow with seamed scars on both cheeks. Doyle, he thought, from the Colchain Estates.
"My lord Bertome," the fellow panted, bowing hastily. "There are 2,000 Terrabonners hard on my heels, and women with them, with lightning on their dresses." "Hard on his heels," Wireman murmured disparagingly. "We'll see what my man has to say when he gets back. I certainly don't see any—"
Sudden whoops in the near distance ahead cut him off, and the thunder of hooves, and then quickly galloping lancers appeared, a flowing tide spreading through the trees, straight toward Bertome and the others. Wireman laughed.
"Kill whoever you wish, whenever you wish, Gedwin,"
he said, drawing sword with a flourish.
"I use the methods I use, and that's that."
Racing back toward his armsmen, he waved the blade over his head, shouting,
"Santiago! Santiago in glory!"
It was no surprise he did not add a shout for his country to those for his house and his greatest love. Spurring in the same direction, Bertome raised his own voice.
"Saigon and Kyrian!"
No need for sword-waving yet.
"Saigon and Kyrian!"
What had the man been after? Thunder rumbled, and Bertome looked to the sky, perplexed. There were a few more clouds than earlier. No. Doyle, Dalin, had mentioned those women. And then he forgot all about whatever the fool tyrant wanted, as steel-veiled Terrabonners poured over the wooded hills toward him, the earth blooming fire and the sky raining lightning ahead of them.
"Saigon and Kyrian!"
he shouted. The wind rose. Horsemen clashed amid thick trees and heavy underbrush, where shadows hung heavily. The light seemed to be failing, the clouds thickening overhead, but it was hard to say with a dense forest canopy for a roof. Booming roars half-drowned the ring of steel on steel, the shouts of men, the screams of horses. Sometimes the ground shook. Sometimes the enemy raised shouts.
"Den Lucenos! Den Lucenos and the bees! Annalyn! Rally to Annalyn! Halen! Halen! For the High Lord Suniman!"
The last was the only cry Varric understood in the least, though he suspected any of the locals who named themselves High Lords or Ladies might not be offered the chance to swear the oath. He jerked his sword free from where he had jammed it into his opponent's armpit, just above the breastplate, and let the pale little man topple. A dangerous fighter until he made the mistake of raising his blade too high. The man's bay crashed off through the undergrowth, and Varric spared a moment for regret. The animal looked better than the white-footed dun he was forced to ride. A moment only, and then he was peering through the close-set trees, where it seemed vines dangled from half the branches and bunches of some gray, feathery plant from nearly all. Sounds of battle rose from every direction, but at first he could see nothing that moved. Then a dozen Altaran lances appeared at 50 paces, walking their horses and peering about carefully, though the way they talked loudly among themselves more than justified the red slashes crisscrossing their breastplates. Varric gathered his reins, meaning to take them in. An escort, even this undisciplined rabble, might be the difference between the urgent message he carried reaching Banner General Chian Mai and not. Black streaks flashed from among the trees, emptying Altaran saddles. Their horses dashed in every direction as the riders fell, and then there were only a dozen corpses sprawled on the damp carpet of dead leaves, at least one crossbow bolt jutting from every man. Nothing moved. Varric shivered in spite of himself. Those foot and blue coats had seemed easy at first, with no pikes to stand behind, but they never came into the open, hiding behind trees, in dips in the ground. They were not the worst. He had been sure after the frantic retreat to the ships at Falma that he had seen the worst he ever could see, the ever-victorious army in a rout. Not half an hour gone, though, he had seen 100 Terrabonners face one lone man in a black coat. 100 lancers against one, and the Terrabonners had been ripped to shreds. Literally ripped to shreds. Men and horses simply exploding as fast as he could count. The slaughter had continued after the Terrabonners turned to flee, went on so long as one of them remained in sight. Perhaps it was really no worse than having the ground erupt beneath your feet, but at least Imani usually left enough of you to be buried. He had been told by the last man he managed to speak to in these woods, a grizzled veteran from home leading 100 Amadisian pikes, that Chian Mai was in this direction. Ahead he spotted riderless horses tied to trees and men afoot. Maybe they could give him further direction. And he would give them the lash of his tongue for standing about while a battle raged. When he rode in among them, he forgot tongue lashings. He had found what he was looking for, but not at all what he wanted to find. A dozen badly burned corpses lay in a row. One, his honey-brown face untouched, was recognizably Chian Mai. The men on their feet were all Terrabonners, Amadisians, Altarans. Some of them were injured, too. The only Shan Chan was a tight-faced Suldam, soothing a weeping Damani. "What happened here?" Varric demanded. He did not think it was like these Ashaman to leave survivors. Maybe the Suldam had fought him off.
"Madness, my lord."
A hulking Terrabonner shrugged away the man who was spreading ointment down his seared left arm. The sleeve appeared to have been burned away clear to the fellow's breastplate, yet despite his burns, he did not grimace. His veil of steel mail hung by a corner from his red-plumed conical helmet, bearing a hard face, with thick gray mustaches that nearly hid his mouth, and his eyes were insultingly direct.
"A group of Ilioners. They fell on us without warning. At first, all went well. They had none of the black coats with them. Lord Chian Mai, he led us bravely. And the woman channeled lightnings. Then just as the Ilioners broke the lightnings, they fell among us, too."
He cut off with a significant look at the Suldam. She was on her feet in an instant, shaking her free fist and striding as far toward the Terrabonner as the leash attached to her other wrist would allow. Her Damani lay in a weeping heap.
"I will not hear this dog's words against my Zakai. She is a good Damani, a good Damani."
Varric made soothing gestures to the woman. He had seen Suldam make their charges howl for misdeeds, and a few who crippled the recalcitrant, but most would bristle even at one of the blood who cast aspersions on a favorite. This Terrabonner was not of the blood, and by the look of the quivering Suldam, she was ready to do murder. Had the man voiced his ridiculous, unspoken charge, Varric thought she might have killed him on the spot.
"Prayers for the dead must wait," Varric said bluntly.
What he was about to do would end with him in the hands of the Seekers if he failed, but there was not a Shan Chan left standing here except the Suldam.
"I am assuming command. We will disengage and turn south."
"Disengage!" the heavy-shouldered Terrabonner barked. "It will take us days to disengage. The Ilioners, they fight like badgers backed into a corner, the Karienin like ferrets in a box. The Tyrans,
They're not so hard as I have heard, but there are maybe a dozen of these Ashaman, yes? I do not even know where 3/4 of my men are in this jolly bag.
Emboldened by his example, the others began giving protest too. Varric ignored them, and forbore asking what a jolly bag was. Looking at the tangled forest all around him, listening to the clash of battle, the booms of explosions and lightnings, he could imagine.
"You will gather your men and begin pulling back," he said loudly, cutting through their chatter. "Not too fast. You will act in unison."
Mirage's orders to Chiang Mai, said with all possible speed. He had memorized them in case something happened to the copy in his saddlebags. All possible speed, but too much speed in this, and half the men would be left behind, chopped to flinders at the enemy's leisure.
"Now move! You fight for the Empress! May she live forever!"
That last was the sort of thing you told fresh recruits, but for some reason the listening men jerked as if he had struck them all with his quirt. Bowing quickly and deeply, hands on knees, they all but flew to their horses.
Strange.
Now it was up to him to find the Shonchan units. One of those would be commanded by someone above him, and he could pass his responsibility. The Suldam was on her knees, stroking her still-weeping Damani's hair, and crooning softly.
"Get her soothed down," he told her, with all possible speed.
And he thought he had seen a touch of anxiety in Mirage's eyes. What could make Kenna Mirage anxious?
"I think we will be depending on you, Suldam, to the south."
Now, why would that make the blood drain from her face? Bashir stood just inside the edge of the trees, frowning through his helmet's face bars at what he saw. His bay nuzzled his shoulder. He held his cloak close against the wind, more to avoid any motion that would draw eyes than for the cold, though that chilled his flesh. It would have been a spring breeze back in Saldaea, but months in the Southlands had softened him. Shining bright between gray clouds that sailed along quickly, the sun still lay a little short of midday, and ahead of him. Just because you began a battle facing west did not mean you ended it that way. Before him lay a broad pasture where flocks of black and white goats cropped at the brown grass in desultory fashion, just as if there was no battle raging all around them. Not that there was any sign of it here, for the moment. A man could get himself cut to doll rags crossing that meadow. And in the trees, whether forest or olive groves or thickets, you did not always see the enemy before you were on top of him, scouts or no scouts.
"If we're going to cross," Gwea muttered, rubbing a wide hand over his bald head, "we should cross. Light's truth, we're wasting time."
Amondrid snapped his mouth shut. Likely the moon-faced Kyrianen had been about to say much the same thing. He would agree with a Tyran when horses climbed trees. Jordwin Samaris snorted. The man should have grown a beard to hide that narrow jaw. It made his head look like a forester's splitting wedge.
"I do say go round," he muttered. "I've lost enough men to those light-cursed Damani, and..."
He trailed off with an uneasy glance toward Rochide. The young Ashaman stood by himself, mouth tight, fingering that dragon pin on his collar. Maybe wondering whether it was worth it, by the look of him. There was no knowing air about the boy now, only frowning worry. Leading quick by the reins, Bashir strode to the Ashaman and drew him farther aside in the trees. Pushed him farther aside. Rochide scowled, going reluctantly. The man was tall enough to loom over Bashir, but Bashir was having none of it.
"Can I count on your people next time?" Bashir demanded, jerking a mustache in irritation. "No delays."
Rochide and his fellows seemed to have grown slower and slower responding when they found themselves opposite Damani.
"I know what I'm about, Bashir," Rochide snarled. "Aren't we killing enough of them for you? As far as I can see, we're about done."
Bashir nodded slowly, not in agreement with the last. There were plenty of enemy soldiers left, almost anywhere you looked hard enough. But a good many were dead. He had patterned his movements on what he had studied of the Trolloc Wars, when the forces of the Light seldom came anywhere near the numbers they had to face. Slash at the flanks and run. Slash at the rear and run. Slash and run. And when the enemy chased after, turn on the ground you had chosen beforehand, where the legionmen lay waiting with their crossbows, turn and cut at him until it was time to run again. Or until he broke. Already today he had broken Terrabonners, Amadisians, Altarans, and these Shonchan in their strange armor. He had seen more enemy dead than in any fight since the Blood Snow. But if he had Ashaman, the other side had those Demani. A good third of his Saldaeans lay dead along the miles behind. Nearly half his force was dead, all told. And there were still more Shonchan out there, with their cursed women, and Terrabonners, and Amadisians, and Altarans. They just kept coming, more appearing as soon as he finished the last. And the Ashaman were growing hesitant. Swinging into Quick's saddle, he rode back to Jordwin and the others.
"We go around," he ordered,
ignoring Jordwin's nods as much as he did Guayam and Amondred's scowls.
"Triple scouts ahead. I mean to push hard, but I don't want to trip over a Demani."
No one laughed. Rochide had gathered the other five Ashaman around him, one with a silver sword pinned to his collar, the others without. There had been two more with bear collars when they started out that morning, but if Ashaman knew how to kill, so did Demani. Waving his arms angrily, Rochide appeared to be arguing with them. His face was red, theirs blank and stubborn. Bashir just hoped Rochide could keep all of them from deserting. Today had been costly enough without adding that sort of man wandering about loose. A light rain fell. Rand scowled at the thick black clouds gathering the sky, already beginning to obscure a pale sun halfway down to the far horizon. Light rain now, but it would thicken like those clouds. Irritably, he returned to studying the land ahead of him. The crown of swords pricked his temples. With the power in him, the land was clear as a map, despite the weather. Clear enough, anyway. Hills sinking away, some covered with thickets or olive trees, others bare grass or just stone and weeds. He thought he saw movement at the edge of a copse, then again among the rows of an olive orchard on another hill a mile from the copse. Thinking was not enough. Dead men lay across the miles behind, dead enemies. Dead women, too, he knew. But he had stayed away from anywhere Suldam and Demani had died, refused to see their faces. Most thought it was hatred for those who killed so many of his followers. Tideshar frisked a few steps on the hilltop before Rand settled him with a firm hand and the pressure of his knees. A fine thing if a Suldam spotted his movement. The few trees around him were not enough to hide much. Vaguely he realized he did not recognize a one of them. Tideshar tossed his head. Rand tucked the dragon scepter into his saddlebags, just the carved butt end sticking out, to free both hands in case the gelding was not satisfied. He could have taken weariness from the horse with Sayadine, but he knew no way to make it obey with the power. He could not see how the gelding retained enough energy. Sayadine filled him, bubbled in him, but his distantly felt body wanted to sag with weariness. Part of that was the sheer amount of the power he had handled today. Part was the strain of fighting Sayadine to make it do what he wanted. Always Sayadine had to be conquered, forced, but never before like today. The half-healed, never-healing wounds in his left side were agony. The older, an auger trying to drill through the void, the newer, a blaze of raw flame.
"It was an accident, my lord dragon," Adley said suddenly. "I swear it was."
"Shut up and watch," Rand told him harshly.
Adley's eyes sank to his hands on his own reins for a moment. Then he raked damp hair out of his face and jerked his head up obediently. Today, here, controlling Sayadine was harder than ever, but letting it slip anytime, anywhere, could kill you. Adley had let it slip, and men had died in uncontrolled bursts of fire, not just the Amadisians he had been aiming at, but near 30 of Ailill's armsmen, and almost as many of Anaila's. Except for his slip, Adley would have been with more, with the companions in the woods half a mile to the south. Narishma and Hopwill were with the defenders to the north. Rand wanted Adley under his eye. Had any other accidents happened out of his sight? He could not watch everyone all the time. Flynn's face was grim as day-old death, and Dashiva, far from looking vague, seemed on the point of sweating with concentration. He still muttered to himself under his breath, so low Rand could not hear even with the power in him, but the man mopped rain from his face continually with a sodden lace-edged linen handkerchief that had grown more than grimy as the day wore on. Rand did not think they had slipped. In any case, neither they nor Adley held the power now. nor would until he instructed them to seize it.
"Is it done?"
Anaïla asked behind him. Heedless of who might be watching out there, Rand wheeled Tidashar around to face her. The Tyran woman started back in her saddle, the hood of her richly elaborate raincape falling to her shoulders. Her cheek gave a twitch. Her eyes might have been full of fear or hate. At her side, Ailill fingered her reins calmly with red-gloved hands.
"What more can you want?"
the smaller woman asked in a cool voice. "A lady being polite to a menial. Barely.
If the size of a victory is accounted by dead enemies, I think today alone will put your name in the histories."
"I mean to drive the Shan Chan into the sea!"
Rand snapped.
"Blight, he had to finish them now, when he had the chance."
He could not fight the Shan Chan and the Forsaken, and the Light alone knew who or what else all at the same time.
"I did it before, and I will again!"
"Do you have the Horn of Valir hidden in your pocket this time?"
Luz Theron asked slyly. Rand snarled at him silently.
"There's someone below," Flynn said suddenly. "Riding up this way. From the west."
Rand pulled his mount back around. Legion men ringed the slopes of the hill, though they hid well enough that he seldom caught sight of a blue coat. None of them had a horse. Who would be riding? Bashir's bay trotted up the slope, almost as though it were level ground. Bashir's helmet hung from his saddle, and the man himself looked tired. Without preamble, he spoke in a flat voice.
"We're finished here. Part of fighting is knowing when to go, and it's time. I've left 500 dead behind, near enough, and 2 of your soldiers for salt. I sent 3 more to find Samaradrid, Gregorin, and Wireman, and tell them to rally on you. I doubt they're in any better condition than I am. How does your butcher's bill run?"
Rand ignored the question. His own dead topped Bashir's by close to 200.
"You had no right sending orders to the others. So long as there are 6 Ashaman left, so long as there's me, I have enough. I mean to find the rest of the Shan Chan army and destroy it, Bashir. I won't let them add Altara to Terraban and Amadisia."
Bashir knuckled his thick mustaches with a wry laugh.
"You want to find them? Look out there."
He swept a gauntleted hand across the hills to the west.
"I can't point to a particular spot, but there are 10, maybe 15,000 close enough to see from here, if those trees weren't in the way. I danced with the Dark One getting through them unseen to reach you. Maybe 100 Demani down there, maybe more. More coming, for sure, and more men. Seems their general has decided to concentrate on you. I suppose it isn't always cheese and ale, being Tavirin."
"If they're out there..."
Rand scanned the hills. The rain fell more heavily. Where had he seen movement? Light, he was tired. Sayadin hammered at him. Unconsciously, he touched the wrapped bundle beneath his stirrup leather. His hand jerked away of its own accord. 10,000? Even 15? Once Samaradrid reached him, and Gregorin and Wireman. More important, once the rest of the Ashaman did. "If they're out there, that's where I'll destroy them, Bashir. I'll hit them from all sides, the way we intended in the first place." Frowning, Bashir reined his horse closer until his knee almost touched Rand's. Flynn moved his mount away, but Adlai was too focused on staring through the rain to notice anything so near, and Dashiva, still wiping his face incessantly, stared with open interest. Bashir lowered his voice to a murmur.
"You aren't thinking straight. That was a good plan in the beginning, but their general thinks fast. He spread out to blunt our attacks before we could fall on him spread out marching. We've cost him even so, it seems, and he's now pulling everything together. You won't catch him by surprise. He wants us to come at him. He's out there waiting for it. Ashaman or no Ashaman, if we stand nose to nose with this fellow, I think maybe the vultures grow fat and nobody rides away."
"Nobody stands nose to nose with the Dragon Reborn," Rand growled. "The Forsaken could tell him that, whoever he is. Right, Flynn? Dashiva?" Flynn nodded uncertainly. Dashiva flinched.
"You think I can't surprise him, Bashir? Watch!"
Pulling the long bundle loose, He stripped away the cloth covering, and Rand heard gasps as raindrops glistened on a sword seemingly made of crystal. The sword that is not a sword.
"Let's see if he's surprised by Kullendor in the hands of the Dragon Reborn, Bashir!"
Cradling the translucent blade in the crook of his elbow, Rand rode Tidashar forward a few steps. There was no reason to. He had no clearer view from there. Except something spidered across the outer surface of the void, a wriggling black web. He was afraid. The last time he had used Kullendor, really used it, he had tried to bring the dead back to life. He had been sure he could do anything then, anything at all, like a madman thinking he could fly. But he was the Dragon Reborn. He could do anything. Had he not proved it time and again? He reached for the source through the sword that is not a sword. Sayadin seemed to leap into Kullendor before he touched the source through it. From pommel to point, the crystal sword shone with a white light. He'd only thought the power filled him before. Now he held more than 10 men could have unaided. 100. He did not know how many. The fires of the sun searing through his head, the cold of all the winters of all the ages eating into his heart. In that torrent, the taint was all the midden heaps in the world emptying into his soul. Sidene still tried to kill him, tried to scour away, burn away, freeze away every scrap of him. But he fought, and he lived for a moment more, and another moment, another. He wanted to laugh. He could do anything. Once, holding Kullendor, he had made a weapon that searched out Shadowspawn through the Stone of Tyr, struck them dead with hunting lightning wherever they stood or ran or hid. Surely there must be something like that to use against his enemies here. But when he called to Luz Theron, only anguished whimpers answered, as if that disembodied voice feared the pain of Sayadin. With Kullendor blazing in his hand, he did not remember raising the blade overhead. He stared at the hills where his enemies hid. They were gray now, with thickening rain, and dense black clouds blocking the sun. What was it he had told Egan Padros? "I am the storm," he whispered, a shout in his ears, a roar. And he channeled. Overhead the clouds boiled. Where they had been the black of soot, they became midnight, the heart of midnight. He did not know what he was channeling. So often he did not, in spite of Asmodean's teaching. Maybe Luz Theron was guiding him, in spite of the man's weeping. Blows of Sayadin spun across the sky, wind and water and fire. Fire. The sky truly did rain lightning. 100 bolts at once. Hundreds. Forked blue-white shafts, stabbing down as far as he could see. The hills before him erupted. Some flew apart under the torrent of lightning like kicked anthills. Flames sprang up in thickets, trees turning to torches in the rain, flames racing through olive orchards. Something struck him hard, and he realized he was picking himself up from the ground. The crown had fallen from his head. Kullendor still blazed in his hand, though. Vaguely he was aware of Tidashar scrambling to his feet, trembling. So they thought to strike back at him, did they? Shoving Kullendor high, he screamed at them,
"Come against me if you dare! I am the storm! Come if you dare, Shaitan! I am the Dragon Reborn!"
1,000 sizzling lightning bolts hailed down from the clouds. Again something struck him down. He tried to fight up again. Kullendor, still shining, lay a pace from his outstretched hand. The sky shattered with lightnings. Suddenly he realized that the way to top him was Bashir, that the man was shaking him. It must have been Bashir who had flung him down.
"Stop it!"
the Saldaean shouted. Blood fanned down his face from a split across his scalp.
"You're killing us, man! Stop!"
Rand turned his head, and one stunned look was enough. Lightnings flashed all around him, in every direction. A bolt stabbed down onto the reverse slope, where Denharad and the armsmen were. The screams of men and horses rose. Anaela and Ailill were both afoot, trying vainly to quiet mounts that reared, eyes rolling, trying to rip reins free. Flynn was bending over someone, not far from a dead horse with legs already stiff. Rand let Sayadin go. He let it go, but for moments it still flowed into him, and lightning raged. The flow into him dwindled, tailed off, and vanished. Dizziness swept through him in its place. For three more heartbeats, two of Kalandor shone where they lay on the ground, and lightning fell. Then silence except for the rising drum of the rain, and the screams from behind the hill. Slowly Bashir climbed off of him, and Rand rose, unaided on his tottering legs, blinking as his sight returned to normal. The Saldaean watched him, as he might have a rabid lion, fingering his sword hilt. Annihila took one look at Rand on his feet, and collapsed in a faint. Her horse dashed away, reins dangling. Ailill, still fighting a rearing animal, spared few glances for Rand. Rand let Kalandar lie where it was for the moment. He was not sure he dared pick it up. Not yet. Flynn straightened, shaking his head, then stood silently as Rand went unsteadily to stand beside him. The rain fell on Jonan Adley's sightless eyes, bulging as if in horror. Jonan had been one of the first. Those screams from behind the hill seemed to slice through the rain. How many more? Rand wondered. Among the defenders, the companions, among... Rain thick as a blanket hid the hills where the Seanchan army lay. Had he hurt them at all, striking out blindly? Or were they still waiting out there with all their demoni, waiting to see how many more of his own he could kill for them? "Set whatever guard you think we need," Rand told Bashir. His voice was iron. One of the first. His heart was iron. "When Gregorin and the others reach us, we'll travel to where the carts are waiting as fast as we can." Bashir nodded without speaking and turned away in the rain.
"I've lost," Rand thought dully. "I'm the dragon reborn. But for the first time, I've lost."
Suddenly Luz Theron raged up inside him, sly digs forgotten.
"I've never been defeated," he snarled. "I am the Lord of the Morning. No one can defeat me."
Rand sat in the rain, turning the crown of swords in his hands, looking at Kalandor lying in the mud. He let Luz Theron rage. Abeldar Yulan wept, grateful for the downpour that hid the tears on his cheeks. Someone would have to give the order. Eventually, someone would have to apologize to the Empress, might she live forever, and maybe to Suroth sooner. Those were not why he wept, though, nor even for a dead comrade. Roughly ripping a sleeve from his coat, he laid it across Mirage's staring eyes, so the rain would not fall on them.
"Send out orders for retreat," Yulan ordered,
and saw the men standing around him jerk. For the second time on these shores, the ever-victorious army had suffered a devastating defeat, and Yulan did not think he was the only one who wept.
Chapter 25 An Unwelcome Return. Seated behind her gilded writing table, Elida fingered an aged dark ivory carving of a strange bird with a beak as long as its body, and listened with some amusement to the six women standing on the other side of the table. Each a sitter for her Aja, they frowned sideways at one another, shifted velvet slippers on the brightly patterned carpet that covered most of the russet floor tiles, twitched at vine-worked shawls so the colored fringes danced, and generally looked and sounded like a gaggle of peevish serving girls, wishing they had the nerve to go for each other's throats in front of their mistress. Frost coated the glassed casements fitted into the windows, so that it was hardly possible to see the snow swirling outside, though sometimes the winds howled with an icy rage. Elida felt quite warm, and not just for the thick logs blazing in the white marble fireplace. Whether these women knew it or not, well, Duhara knew, certainly, and perhaps the others did, she was their mistress. The elaborate gold-covered case clock that Semaila had commissioned ticked away. Semaila's vanished dream would come true. The tower returned to its glory, and firmly in the capable hands of Elida d'Avrinia Royhan.
"No Tarangrial has ever been found that can control a woman's channeling," Velina was saying in a voice cool and precise, but almost girlishly high-pitched.
a voice at strong odds with her eagle's beak of a nose and her sharp, tilted eyes. She sat for the white, and was the very model of a white sister, in all but her fierce appearance. Her plain, snowy dress seemed stark and cold. Very few have ever been found that perform the same function. Therefore, logically, if such a Tarangreal were found, or more than one, improbable as that must be, there could not be sufficient of them to control more than two or three women at most. It follows that the reports of these so-called Shanchen are exaggerated wildly. If women on leashes exist, they cannot channel. Plainly not. I do not deny these people hold Ebudar and Amador and perhaps more, but clearly they are but a creation of Randall Thor, perhaps to frighten people into flocking to him, like this prophet of his. It is simple logic. I am very glad you don't deny Amador and Ebudar, at least, Velina, Siobhan said dryly, and she could be very dry indeed. As tall as most men, and bonily thin with it, the brown sitter had an angular face and a long chin, not improved by a cap of curls. With spidery fingers she rearranged her shawl and smoothed skirts of dark golden silk, and her voice took on pointed amusement. I'm uncomfortable saying what can and can't be. For example, not long gone, everyone knew only a shield woven by a sister could stop a woman channeling. Then comes a simple herb, fork root, and anyone at all can feed you a tea that leaves you unable as a stone to channel for hours. Useful with unruly wilders or the like, I suppose, but a nasty little surprise for those who think they knew everything, eh? Maybe next someone will learn to make Tarangreal again. Elida's mouth tightened. She did not concern herself with impossibilities, and if no sister had managed to rediscover the making of Tarangreal in 3,000 years, one never would, and that was that. It was knowledge slipping through her fingers when she wanted it held close that curled Elida's tongue. In spite of all her efforts, every last initiate in the tower had learned of Forkroot now. No one liked knowing in the least. No one liked suddenly being vulnerable to anyone with a knowledge of herbs and a little hot water. That knowledge was worse than poison, as the sitters here made clear. At mention of the herb, Duhara's big dark eyes grew uneasy in her coppery face, and she held herself more stiffly than usual, hands clutching skirts so red they seemed nearly black. Sidora actually swallowed, and her fingers tightened on the worked leather folder Elida had handed her, though the round-faced yellow usually carried herself with a frosty elegance. Andaya shivered. She actually wrapped her gray-fringed shawl around her convulsively. Elida wondered what they would do if they learned the Ashaman had rediscovered traveling. As it was, they were barely able to make themselves speak of them. At least she had managed to hold that knowledge to a handful. "I think we might better concern ourselves with what we know to be true, yes?" Andaya said firmly, back in control of herself. Her light brown hair, brushed till it gleamed, hung flowing down her back, and her silver-slashed blue dress was cut in the style of Andor, but Tarabon still rested strongly on her tongue. Though neither particularly small nor particularly slim, she somehow always reminded Elida of a sparrow about to hop on a branch. A most unlikely-appearing negotiator, though her reputation had been earned. She smiled at the others, not very pleasantly, and that seemed sparrow-like, too. Perhaps it was how she held her head. Idle speculation, it wastes precious time. The world hangs by a thread, and myself, I do not wish to fritter away valuable hours prattling about supposed logic, or chattering over what every fool and novice knows. Does anyone have anything useful to say? For a sparrow, she could put acid on her words. Velina's face went red, and Siobhan's darkened. Rubinda twisted her lips at the gray. Perhaps they were meant to make a smile, but they merely seemed to writhe. With raven-black hair and eyes like sapphires, the Mayenner usually looked as if she intended to walk through a stone wall, and planting her fists on her hips now, she seemed ready to walk through too. We've dealt with what we can for the time being, Andaya, most of it anyway. The rebels are caught by the snows in Murundi, and we'll make winter hot enough for them that in the spring they'll come crawling back to apologize and beg penance. Tyr will be taken care of as soon as we find where the High Lord Darlin has vanished to,
and Carrion, once we root Caroline Domadred and Toram Riotan out of their hiding places. Althor has the crown of Ilion for the moment, but that's in work. So unless you have a scheme for snaffling the man into the tower or making the so-called Ashaman vanish, I have the business of my Aja to be about." Andaya drew herself up, her feathers well and truly ruffled. For that matter, Duhara's eyes narrowed. Mention of men who could channel always lit fires in her head. Siobhan clicked her tongue as if a children squabbling, though she looked pleased to see it. And Velina frowned, for some reason sure Siobhan had aimed at her. This was amusing, but getting out of hand. "The business of the Ajahs is important, daughters." Elida did not raise her voice, but every head swiveled toward her. She replaced the ivory carving with the rest of her collection in the large box covered with roses and golden scrolls, carefully adjusted the positions of her writing case and correspondence box so the three lacquered boxes lined up just so on the table. And once their silence was perfect, she went on. "The business of the tower is more important, though. I trust you will effect my decrees promptly. I see too much sloth in the tower. I fear Sylviana may find herself very busy if matters do not come right soon." She did not voice any further threat. She merely smiled. "As you command, mother," murmured six voices, not so steady as their owners might have wished. Even Duhara's face was pasty pale as they made their curtsies. Two sitters had been stripped of their chairs, and half a dozen had served days of labor for penance, which was humiliating enough in their position to be mortification of the spirit besides. Siobhan and Sidora certainly wore tight mouths, as they remembered all too well scrubbing floors and working in the laundries, but none had been sent to Sylviana for mortification of the flesh. No one wanted to be. The mistress of novices had two or three visits each week from sisters who had been given penance by their ajahs, or set one for themselves. A dose of the strap, however painful, was done with much more quickly than raking garden paths for a month. But Sylviana possessed considerably less mercy with sisters than with the novices and accepted in her charge. More than one sister must have spent the next few days wondering whether a month pulling a rake might not have been preferable after all. They scurried toward the doors, eager to be away. Sitters or no, not one would have set foot this high in the tower without Elida's direct summons.